You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
And I'm telling you, I grew fucking balls, man. Like, working the bands that I worked with and with the people that I worked with, you had to, like, so Siobhan, you asked me about, like, being a woman in the industry, and you just fucking go. You don't think about it. You just do what you got to do and go. Doesn't matter if I, you know, have a vagina or not. It's like, I just got to get what I got to get done.
Hello, welcome to another episode of 2020. My name's Corey Paza, here as always with Siobhan Cronin and Benny Goodman. What up?
I think we might have lost Ben.
Yeah, you know, we've had a range of substances ingested throughout the last few episodes, and Ben's just on a new one that's, I'm not going to lie, I kind of dig it. It's keeping him quiet. But this episode... brought to you by Lost Symphony, as always. We actually get
the chance. Pfizer.
We're back. Yes. We're back for part two with our wonderful publicist for Lost Symphony and other bands that you may have heard of, Maria Ferrero, and more great stories.
She's the matriarch of music, man.
And like, you gotta check awesome. Out the YouTube cast too, also, I wanna say, and subscribe 2020-d.com. So many great images and like photos and a lot of great like visual material in these episodes. So don't miss out on it for sure.
And subscribe. Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Benny Goodman, and you've just been 2020 by myself and my cohorts in crime, Siobhan Cronin and Corey Paza. Ladies and gentlemen, give them a golf clap in your wherever you're listening or watching. And this week we have, honestly, one of my favorite people on the planet. We've been working with her with our band Lost Symphony. She's literally a matriarch of metal. In fact, she has the moniker that has been bestowed upon her by one of the godfathers of metal himself, Mr. James Hetfield, of a band called Metallica. And she is Metal Maria Ferrero of Adrenaline PR, but also the reason why my mixtapes when I was growing up exist. So hi, Maria.
Hey, everybody. Keep it metal.
Wanted to say that we, as Ben was like giving you all these compliments at the end of part one, which by the way, anyone listening, go check it out. You've got to listen to part one. So many great stories. But I have to give you a lot of props for being a woman in the industry, because I know what it feels like now in the 2020s, let's say, to be a girl that plays in the world of metal. And it had to have been crazy when you were like just getting into it in like the 80s and 90s. Like,
yeah, women.
On that note, I'm going to take my Klonopin.
We were looked at differently, and it was normal. So it really didn't faze me. You know, like you saw Motley Crue and how they behaved, and that was just, oh, that's Motley Crue, and that's how it is. And then look at modern day, like look at Marilyn Manson. I'll compare, like, to me, it's the same thing. You know, why was it okay then, and it wasn't okay now.
Mm-hmm. You know, well, Manson, so it was rock and roll then, but now it's just statutory rape.
But why was it rock and roll then?
I don't know. That's what I'm asking.
It was not a thing.
I'm saying that that's the difference between cancel culture and Rolling Stone in 1981.
Yeah. But being a woman in the industry, here I am.
Well, how do you feel about it? You are a woman in the industry. So why don't you just tell us how you feel? Because I feel like if there's honestly, anyone that has a right to talk about it, it's you. Yeah.
A lot of people might not like my opinion, and I'm sorry.
But you're a woman, so like you're there. So tell us how you feel as a woman watching this.
I honestly feel that maybe women put themselves into bad situations sometimes, and can't get out of it. And I feel like some of the women that went along with Marilyn Manson, like dated him, and he was all bad and weird. Like, why did they go along with it? Why didn't they get out right away? Or why didn't they report something right away? And it bothers me. That happens, that women let it happen and go along with it and then later say something. It's like, but why didn't you just deal with it when it was going on? It bothers me. I'm sorry. That's my opinion. When it comes to Manson, and I also feel like all the managers and labels that made money off him, that like dropped him, return the money that you made off him. If he's no good, like give the money back, you know? And that's how I feel, you know, that's how I feel about, you know, Chef Mario Batali, right? You know, he had the same situation happen. It's like all these people, these businesses, they make money off these people and that's okay. No, it's not, you know, or take that money and invest it into, you know, women's shelters or helping women to be able to stand up and defend themselves a little bit more, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, I guess first off, if there's anything I've learned from Extreme, there's three sides to every story. So that's one.
Yeah.
And two, I got to say that, you know, look, it's a slippery slope because there's one side, which is fucking creepy men. But that's everyone and everywhere. And that's been since the dawn of time. But two, when you are, I guess, a guy like Marilyn Manson who proclaims like all the crazy stuff that he always has. And like, listen, when I was younger, I used to hear stuff like he removed his ribs so he could suck his dick and that he like carved him. I know he carved himself on stage. I've seen him bleed. He's thrown up. He's done all kinds. Like he did that stuff. So I guess like if it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, I mean, I guess at what point do you say I shouldn't drink this absinthe?
Right. No, don't hang with Manson if you're not into like freaky shit. Okay, sure.
Yeah.
But no means no, you know, no means no still. And I totally get and respect that 110%, 1,000,000%. But I don't know. It's weird. You know, even like I'll throw Mike Tyson into that whole thing, which, you know, he went to jail for all that. And it's like, girl, you were naked in his hotel room. Why did you put yourself there? Why did you, you know, do that? And no means no. So it's just really rough. Sorry to go off on some weird tangent.
No, you're saying like don't walk around the, you know, the Bronx in the middle of the night with like a giant, you know, members only jacket and a bunch of $100 bills sticking out of the back of your pocket.
Well, all right, but that, but getting away from that, that wasn't even necessarily what I was.
Sorry.
No, it's okay.
Siobhan's the pacifist.
No, I'm not trying to do that. But what I was actually interested in hearing is what it feels like to be, or maybe early on, what it felt like to be a woman working in the industry, and you know, just in terms of like having your opinion respected, or what in a world of dudes, you know, like it's an interesting question.
Was it something to think about though? It just was like I'm in the room, I have a voice, I have something to say, I'm going to say it, and people listened, and that's just what it was. I really thankfully was never in a position where I was looked down on or felt like I was looked down upon because I was a woman, or that my opinion didn't matter, or that I couldn't help a situation. You know, I was always part of a team of the right people. And that's maybe great. That's the advice, to align yourself with the right people. And if you're in situations that don't feel good, just get out of that. You know,
I have an important question, because this alludes back to something you said on the last episode. Is we had asked you about Metallica and why they haven't remixed, you know, And Justice for All, an absolute masterpiece. And you texted one Kirk Hammett. Do you think that you have the power as an influential woman, a matriarch of metal,
as dubbed
Metal Maria by James Hetfield himself? Don't you think that you should get And Justice for All remastered on behalf of all Metallica fans everywhere? And not just remastered, but remixed, where you get James.
I say no, Benny.
Leave it as is.
What are they going to do next? We got to move forward. What are they going to make next? Metallica's Kill 'Em All.
Unforgiven 4.
But when Kill 'Em All came out, it sounded so garage and rough. It still does. Should that be redone?
That's a good point.
No, they're a snapshot in time, and that's kind of that's what they always use. A lot of artists do that.
I'm just joking for the sake of archivists, because you know, back then when I was younger and cared about these things, I feel like if I heard bass in Justice for All now, I'd find it disconcerting.
Well, like, if you do want to get your fix, you can listen to And Justice for Jason, which is on YouTube, where someone played the bass that should have been there.
It's fake because you can't get bass out of nothing.
Well, it's not fake. It's
what the tab said.
They didn't lie. They say they overdubbed the bass, but you get to hear the songs, what they would sound like with bass. It's very nice. But what I would like to kind of take a moment and you know, I don't want to let your expertise and your experience go to waste. We definitely need more stories, but I want to hear your views and opinions on the music industry as it stands in 2021. You're kind of in the trenches out there. You represent a lot.
Coming out of the pandemic.
Yeah. So, you know, can you give us like, you know, maybe pre-pandemic versus post-pandemic kind of what your
pre-pandemic was spinning like orbiting, just flying, bands touring, records coming out, magazines engaging, people, you know, really interested, and things felt really moving. The pandemic just slapped down, squashed, done, and just cranking it. It seems like so hard to get people interested in things, getting responses from people. And a lot of it is because personally, for what, a year plus, homeschooling families, people getting sick, people afraid, people mentally melting down, like, you know, in a box forever, you know, not being able to leave your house, see family, see friends or whatever. It's been hard. The industry as a whole, though, it's incredible. It's changed so much. And I feel that the best thing to do is create your own situations. Just take charge, take control, put together the right teams, be flexible, flexible to change gears immediately on planning decisions. I think right now I'm still wondering about COVID and if it is safe for concerts and stuff. Even with the vaccines, I definitely got the vaccine, didn't want to, but got it. And I still don't know if I'm safe. Yeah. So I think coming out of COVID, it's tough. Bands are touring, you know, we're busier now with bands that are touring. You know, I think that's the most important thing, to be active, because then people are going to care more. Magazines are going to cover you. Journalists are going to care, spreading the word. Radio stations, I don't really even know what's going on in that world at all. But touring, it's key, being active and getting fans to engage again and get back to normal. It's really important.
Is that why Yngwie Malmsteen responds to a bunch of people online now? Because I find this weird, because now I'm seeing all these strange kind of, I don't want to say death throngs, but like these people that are in these legacy elements. And I love Yngwie Malmsteen, all right? Because I love him. And like, I think that neoclassical music is cool, but like he's kind of become a little bit of a cliche of himself. And I first off noticed that on his YouTube, they've shut off all of the thumbs down. You can't, and all the comments are curated. So only the curated.
I don't think you can shut off the thumbs down.
I don't know how he did it. It's literally only good comments. Okay. And like, if you have any thumbs down, it goes away. It just does. And on Facebook, I've noticed that he, like, out of nowhere, first off, his response to everything is just pick up a guitar. I hope I inspired you to play a guitar. But he writes thumbs up to people who are like, I'm coming to this gig and all that. I'm like, is this what Yngwie has to do now? Is go on his phone while he's in his Ferrari taking a crap and just literally go on Instagram or Facebook and just respond like, oh, be at the VIP for $400. Is that what you have to do now? Like in the music industry, when Yngwie back in the day used to show up with just like a smoke machine and have a singer come out and be like, it's Yngwie fucking Malmsteen, and then get punched in the face.
Anyways, so
where's that going?
It went.
I'm saying he
has
to go online, and instead of actually fucking, you know, getting anybody else involved, he goes and personally responds to people and curates his own fucking shit.
We'll take that statement and say, Maria, like as far as engagement goes with your artists, what do you see now that's, you know, maybe the most successful, and you can go back 5 years, but what's like the most successful way you've seen your artists and maybe up and coming artists build and connect with their audience?
Be consistent with social media, you know, and really active. And I know it might sound like, you know, street team marketing 101, but like literally the bands that you want to like tour with, if you're a smaller band, you know, if you want to tour with Metallica, who follows Metallica? Go make friends with all of their followers. Say, hey, check out my band. And how exciting for like a fan to just get a message from a band member, like, you know, to check them out. You know, I just feel like really engaging with fans directly. And while people are sitting around doing not much, that's a cool thing to do.
Yeah.
I keep telling Siobhan, if she DMs anybody on Instagram, that they'll come on our show, because she can just be like, I'm the violinist in Star Set and I'm talented and I'm a girl and I'm pretty. Come on our show. And she thinks that that's not a thing, but it's a thing.
You're right. But what I mean, I think Maria's right, though, that engagement, I mean, you know, ultimately interacting with the people that support you is what's most important, whether it's getting out on stage or, you know, engaging with them online or something. I mean, that's what people want. You know, they want to have some sort of connection to you or some sort of interaction. And that's what keeps them coming back.
Yeah, they're connected to your music, or like that's the first thing. And you know, but it's the opposite if they're not a fan, right? So get them to connect with your music.
Right. Absolutely. Oh, no, you know, question.
And on your end, you know, aside, pandemic aside, like what is your, you know, kind of day-to-day operation with adrenaline? Like what do you see as your responsibility and how do you execute it?
You know, if we're working a project, if it's, you know, whatever kind of a campaign, if it's just a press release, coordinating details, you know, making sure everything's approved and right. If it's a full campaign, it's basically constantly pitching, you know, all kinds of angles, different stories, based on different, you know, based on interest, not even just your music, just to cross over into, you know, cross marketing to say if, you know, Benny is a knitter. He knits, he's a master knitter. I'm going to find the magazines that...
This is knit, no crochet.
Oh my God.
He did not do that. He did not do that though.
Hey, I'm going to find crochet magazines and I'm going
to... Just so you know, this cat is in Gates to Babylon and the new Power Man video from David Abruzzese.
I love the green eyes.
I love everything about Velvel. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Continue. Seriously. I think that's, you know, just dealing with everything that comes in, the 500 fucking emails a minute, coordinating campaigns, press releases, dealing with personalities. Squashing things sometimes, like, no, you're not ready yet. Just navigating, paying bills, getting paid. That's what I do.
Let me ask you a question, because we kind of skipped over a big chunk of your career from, you know, we jumped to some stories, but you know, what were maybe some key moments, or, you know, how did you learn how to be a good publicist? Like, you know, you didn't go to school for, like, what are some things in your life that helped you understand the business? I'm just curious.
Where you got I was that suburban kid reading magazines. It meant a lot to me to read about my artists. So now I'm on the other side. I get to push the artists to be represented in the magazine. I care about the artists. I care about the fans. I'm a fan. So I just want to see it all through and make it happen and go and grow and do more and bigger and make a difference and keep going, you know?
Do you feel like you could make a difference in music? Cause I feel like in everything, like when they're like, go vote or do this I feel horrible. Cause like inside my soul, I'm like, I'm supposed to do this, and everything on television is like, rock the vote. P. Diddy told me to. But then meanwhile, like with music, I feel like you did change it. And I now feel like Metallica, like, should tip their hat to you, and that Kirk should be texting you back by now, because
yeah, what the
shame
fuck?
On him. Like, does he know who he's fucking talking
Nothing.
To?
Nothing.
Maybe he lost his phone again, and there goes their next Metallica record.
Do you know what happened?
I would love to know.
He was riding his bike and he lost his phone.
But he doesn't have a cloud. He doesn't have like iCloud. I mean, I have a Galaxy.
In Oahu, just riding his bike.
So somewhere in Oahu, there's the unreleased Metallica.
That's the name of the next record, The Unreleased. Yeah. And they can ride that for another at least three records.
All right, I'm losing track here.
I just think it's hilarious because I think Kirk Hammett should totally write you back. And what is his, what is he text like? What is a text from Kirk like? Is he one of those guys? Because like when Nuno texts me, the syntax is perfect. And then he writes like a poem, like it's iambic pentameter, and like there's the proper amount of returns used.
It's me asking him if he'll come to Hawaii to play guitar at Marsha's spreading of her ashes.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, no, but he said he if he's around, he will hear. It's hard to say where I'll be at that point, but if I'm around, we will meet. Cool.
Wow, that is
always an angel. What else? I got a lot of pictures. Him saying yum to all my pics.
Can you send me that food?
I like it. Porn. I like it to the pattern. It's like, you know.
Well, I mean, Kirk Hammett, we all know his style's outrageous. So obviously he probably. Totally.
Capizio. Benny.
If I was Metallica,
Benny, yeah. Capizio, what does this mean to you?
First off, it sounds like it's a salad.
No,
I should put capers on it.
No, Kirk Hammett and Capizio. Do you remember he would wear the white Capizios? The shoes.
Okay, I know exactly what that looks like. I just didn't know that's the name for them.
Yeah, it's a ballet shoe.
Well, you mentioned his style, so we're gonna start.
No, I love his style because he really is like a total
square one. Kirk shows up in motherfucking white capizios. Okay,
they also did the Metallica hats because of like that whole thing too, which I thought was hilarious.
It started with the capizios.
Well, I saw him wear those for a long time. He's crazy. His style is awesome.
Yeah.
Like, so if I was Kirk Hammett, I would get like ESP cases done on Louis Vuitton because fuck you, everybody, because I'm Kirk Hammett. Yeah. I would do that. I would literally do everything that he's doing is exactly what I'd do. I'd develop some weird style. I'd have crazy jewelry, as you can see. Like,
You do have weird style.
I do now. And you know what? I became friends with Shannon Larkin from Godsmack, and he sends me all these crazy like jewelry he has custom made. And I'm like, I don't need those biker rings, but like, I think maybe I do. I love skulls.
Yeah. Sell me one of those.
I know. I'll let him know. I'm selling it to Metal Maria. Don't be mad at me.
So getting back to Metal Maria. So we kind of jumped around like before, but in our other episode, you kind of gave us the intro and then like a whole bunch of stories. I want to go back to when you first moved to California because you were telling us stories about meeting Megadeth when they first got started. I want to hear what happened after you hopped on the plane, went to California.
Okay. So I got there. My friend ends up, she's doing bad drugs. David Ellison and Mustaine say, come live with me. I was selling glow in the dark keychains on the phone, telemarketing. That was my job. So every day I'd get up at like 6 something in the morning. Those guys were passed out. I'd get up, I'd go to work, I'd do my phone calls.
What's the pitch? Hold on. Slow that down, Maria, please. You called up and you were trying to sell glow. This is in the 80s. So obviously technology was different. People and time was slower. So there were people that actually responded to somebody randomly calling them and saying, do you want to buy?
Filled with us.
So how did the call go? So let's just do a call. Hello?
Hi, this is Maria. How are you today?
I'm doing great. How about yourself, Maria?
Excellent. I've got these glow-in-the-dark keychains that we could create for you with your business. We could put your logo on it. Would you be interested? They're really cheap.
Wow, you could put my logo on something that glows in the dark. I am sold.
Oh my God.
I need a keychain for my Chrysler LeBaron.
Yeah, but anyway, I did well. And my boss would say, Maria, you could sell ice cubes to an Eskimo. So I did really good. I think I was making like 700, 800 bucks a week. And 1983 at 17, it was good.
Yeah. It was good.
So, but it was weird. Like, I remember walking to work one morning and a homeless guy had this, like, a dumpster. Like, he was pushing a dumpster and he was like, hey, babe, want to ride? It scared me. You know, I was a kid. Like, yeah. So that was that. And, like, the guys in Megadeth, it was Junior Ellison, Mustaine, and, God, Greg Handavitt was the other guitar player, kid from Minnesota, one of Ellison's friends. And then some other kids, these two kids, I just don't remember their name, but they all had a van and we would travel from the apartment in the van to the Troubadour and go to shows and shit. And like people like David Lee Roth would be hanging out at the Troubadour, just like drinking, you know, sitting right there and you could walk up to him, or Jakey Lee. Like just that whole era was crazy. Nikki Sixx, one day I ran into him leaving the Troubadour. And during that time, Motley Crue, you never saw them without makeup. And he was out without makeup and I knew it was him. He was carrying his journal. It said crew. And I have the photo someplace. I'm going to find it. I haven't. But it's Nikki holding the thing up so you can only see, like, basically from the bottom of his nose up. And it was just wild, you know, like crazy days. Just hanging out, wild fucking Hollywood scene, a real scene. Like, and New York had a real scene, too. It's totally feeling a bit different these days in music, the scene. There's a good scene. It's just not the same. I don't know how to say it. You know, like people know each other and, you know, the bands, everybody engages and tours together and supports each other. And that's a good scene. But I don't know. It seems like the local scene is lacking, you know?
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah.
That's something that I never really got to experience. The scene, what you can call it, around Boston, Providence, when I started playing in bands 15 something years ago, was kind of like on the tail end. So like my first few shows when I was like, I had the X's on my hand because I was 13 in a bar with everyone smoking. I'm like, this is amazing. There's a million people here. My crappy band opened the night. And then, you know, 3 or 4 years later when I suck a lot less, I go to the same bar and there's eight people sitting at the bar and
well, it's
no
funny
one cares.
You say that, Corey, because I mean, I know I'm only a few years older than Corey, but I guess I'm lucky enough because I was at the end of analog and I was at the end of like what was a boom in Boston because you had bands like Godsmack and Stained and Killswitch Engage and Shadows Fall and like Power Man 5000, Rob Zombies from Haverhill himself. You know, like there's a lot, so much stuff was coming out of Boston. And I was in a band called Carve, and we got big on WSOU, which was big in New Jersey. And they fucking, dude, when we went out to Jersey, we played to 500 people in like a gym. And I remember you could go to Jared's place, which is a place where I know Corey had his first awesome guitar destroyed in front of his face, which is what you need to do if you want to be crowned into heavy metal, is watch someone else destroy your guitar on stage, because that's metal.
I guess I'm metal then.
But I remember on any Friday or Thursday night, you could go and there were always good bands. There were always good bands, and people would always be there just because they wanted to drink, hang out, and watch music because you didn't have smartphones. There wasn't like UFC on every fucking day or something to distract you. You're like, Thursday night, metal night. I go down there and I'm going to see bands. And I remember when we did Loco Bazooka, which was this huge giant festival, that there were 25,000 people there the first few years that we did it. It was fucking crazy. And I remember looking out and it looked like one of those Deep Purple photos from like back in the day, like the MK3 era. And you're like, holy shit, this is what it feels like. And then 5 years later, you're playing a side stage. There's Bumblefoot. He's playing to 147 people. Alice Cooper's on another stage. It's a half-filled arena. And you're like, you got Dio with Sabbath and it's only like three quarters filled and there's just promoters walking around like, what the fuck? There's Ronnie is playing with Tony Iommi. What the hell's going on? And that's when I knew the music industry was going up to fucking flames.
The gist, though, is, you know, now, because obviously it's not the 80s anymore and that scene doesn't exist. Maria, how do you tackle that for your artists? Like, how do you...
Yeah, it's a new scene and more is on the artist, and you guys really have to get socially active, you know, touring or being social or both.
Yeah, I wish we could tour.
Yeah.
Because social media is hard enough.
But seriously, why are you guys not touring?
We've never been in the same room, Maria.
I know, so why not put it together?
Money.
I think it's possible, but yeah, logistically it is, you know,
I am a DJ. We could totally just DJ the background tracks and then just get like Joey Concepcion, who's like a goddamn tape recorder, just to like spit out every riff.
Welcome to Rockville. Maybe Hellfest in France. Like, why not?
Help.
Yeah.
Because we'd love to do all those things. We're just not that smart, Maria. Like, we're smart in that we made a podcast and I'm doing the neurotic guitar. So, like, actually, tomorrow morning, I'm going to New Jersey to see Les Paul's estate because apparently there's a bunch of guitars and music and his first eight track recorders. And Paul Reed Smith has even agreed.
Yep. And before we get too there, far off topic, we'll just
continue.
Again.
I'm
sorry.
You'll lose me.
I'm on the Terrapin Station train, so 16 minutes of craziness and waiting for everybody at Shakedown Street.
There you go.
But yeah, so they're clearly the importance of like being social and engaging with the audience is huge, which I think now that we have our latest single, Taking Out the Piece, has actually brought in for the first time, I think, an audience that didn't, you know, we didn't hear about us directly from us posting,
a little,
you know,
conflagration.
Yeah, no, creating your best content, right? Having a team push it and everybody just stay focused and, you know, what's the next goal? And you guys have nailed so many things and the Slay at Home was really just a good hit for you guys on top of everything.
So yeah.
Those were fun because I was working on those anyway because they were all like manic last minute. So poor Corey has like gray hairs named after every one of those videos. But I was like, oh, well, I was already doing this Skid Row mashup, so fuck you guys. I guess we got to do it for real now. And the biggest compliment I feel like we've learned from Slay at Home is that people don't know what electric violin sounds like in metal at all because they're like, I don't hear it. And we're playing Van Halen and she's a whole channel coming out the right ear, but they think it's a phaser guitar. But it's her.
It's great.
It's cool. I it's like fun for me to be a violinist that's like somewhat in the metal scene because it is like kind of uncharted territory. Like people just don't even know
It elevates the music. It
just, and you're not the wife of a singer. That's what most people would think you are. They'd judge you. You could be like, no, I actually play in the band. And they're like, what? And you're not the singer. You're like, no, I play violin. And they're like, what?
Yeah. Elevation.
Okay, so Maria, what was the end of your glow-in-the-dark keychain story?
Oh, God. So, yeah, just, you know, that was it. That was my job, and that's how I made money. And, you know, I lived with the guys, and we would go out to clubs and just see every metal show, and there was one every night, you know?
Did you see them with your glow-in-the-dark keychain?
No, but I want to know, how did that job end? What was the next?
Oh, I called my dad. After how many months? I was out there 3 months. I called my dad. I said, I want to come home. I just quit my job and went home. I was 17. Hollywood was not for me. I didn't want to be a glow in the dark keychain salesperson. I missed Megaforce Records. I missed Johnny and Marsha. I missed my dog. And I was like, can you buy me a ticket home? My father said, of course. He said, but I really wish you would have made me buy you a round trip ticket. It would have been cheaper. I remember that comment. And that was it. So I came home, went right back to Megaforce, and it was good for me, I think, to go away and come back. And I had that connection still because I was living with, you know, Metallica's ex-guitar player, you know.
So do you say, is it true that you don't know what you've got till it's gone?
Of course.
Anyways.
God. Yeah, no, it was just, you know, time to move on, came home, did that. And, you know, time went on. The whole Metallica, they left. Anthrax was our focus. We managed them, and it was all about blowing them up. And boy, did we. Fuck, John and Marsha killed it. Anthrax deals. So the very end of the Megaforce Metallica Unity was a show at the Roseland Ballroom. It was Metallica, Raven, and Anthrax. And we managed all three bands. And that night we signed Metallica to Elektra, Anthrax to Island, and Raven to Atlantic. And the next day, Cliff Bernstein and Lars Ulrich had a meeting, and they said, you know, we're going to be your new manager, fire Johnny. So Johnny signed them to a new label, no longer on Megaforce, and now they lost them as management. So Anthrax became like everything. Yeah. And then, you know, the next level, I said how Testament was like, got to have them, got to have my band. They were the big five. To me, Testament was even better than Metallica, way better, because they had Chuck Billy singing. James's vocal style, people kind of made fun of him. He wasn't that amazing. Honestly, you know, the first...
Maybe I'm amazed.
Honestly, yeah. So whatevs, that's that.
So what, you've gone from publicist without even realizing you were a publicist, essentially, just like, oh, I'm making these calls now, I'm a publicist, mm-hmm. to managing Testament. Like, how the hell did that, like, that, like, when did you get to the point where you're like, I'm gonna manage a band? Like, what did that
take? It was a joke. We all were sitting around.
So that was the first time it ever came up.
Ever.
Okay.
And then Ozzy was like, bark at the moon.
It was a joke. So we went with it, and it really went. And they, like I said, every good booking agent took them on.
Yeah.
Best tours they could get. They blew up good records. It happened.
So prior to that, just publicist was your moniker as far
that was
as.
It. Yeah. From Megaforce. I was there for 13 years, went to TVT Records. Actually, I did product management for KMFDM at TVT Records for 3 years. While I did publicity, Seven Dust as well. And that was fun.
Yeah. I love Seven Dust.
And then I got married. And my husband died 7 months after we got married of a heart attack. Go ahead, Benny. Give me a joke. I know a joke's coming.
No, that's not funny.
Okay.
Jesus.
So that happened. And I realized life is short and I want to be a chef. So I left the music business, went to cooking school, became a chef. And I did it pretty big. I worked at a 4-star French restaurant in New York. And I trained in Berkeley, California at Chez Panisse, all organic, farm to table, Chef Alice Waters, like icon, look her up. And then I went back to New York City after my thing at Chez Panisse in Cali. And my second night at work at a French Japanese restaurant called Bond Street, I got hit by a truck crossing the street.
What the fuck?
Yeah, broke my hip. herniated discs in my back, like crazy shit. My head split open. It was so bad. And so I went back to music. Like I did.
Is that the universe? Hold on, wait. Was that the universe literally hitting you with the truck saying maybe it's time to step away from the umami and get back to the metal?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
Drop the sushi knife.
Hold on, but that's crazy. That's really crazy. So what, first off,
I clawed my way back.
But I tip my hat to you for saying, you know, later in life that you've already established yourself. You've already done like a lot of really pivotal things that like nobody can deny at this point. And you're like, you know what? And listen, I make fun of a lot of things, but like I didn't find any humor in that because it probably has to be a hurtful thing to be married to somebody. So for that, I hope that like, if anything, that it changed you and that when you took that time to, again, that's wonderful. That's, you guys look beautiful.
Oh my God.
That's really a beautiful picture. Now you're going to make me cry. So thanks. Congratulations, Maria Ferrero. Ugh.
You are such a badass. I love that you
really are. Like now I'm just like, but he made you want to cook. So for that,
let Siobhan go.
No, it's okay. I mean, I was just dovetailing on that. Yeah. Like good for you for just like going with your gut and like doing something, you know, like you definitely.
Oh my God. Yeah, I was like, I'm going to cook. Yeah. I'm going to get a tattoo of a chef on my fucking arm too.
But wait for the universe to say, hey, you know what? Maybe it's time. And so they're like, oh, we'll just hit you with a fucking truck. And instead of doing Angel's Son, you're back to managing Seven Dust.
That's the mighty demo pile at Megaforce. You see that pile?
It's a little out of focus, but it's pull it
the
back
pile
a little
on
bit.
The floor.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yep. That's some old school shit right there.
The demo pile. Okay.
Amazing. Where Testament's demo came to life.
That's crazy.
And violence.
Crazy.
And then I signed Ministry to management too. That was pretty cool. 1990 to 1996. And I was Al's publicist, Ministry's publicist. They were on the cover of every fucking magazine and it was boom. It was so good. They toured Lollapalooza and it just fucking blew up. It was so great.
I remember that one of the only requests of, was it Stanley Kubrick when he had Steven Spielberg direct that crazy movie AI, was that you have to put Ministry in that movie. You have to put Ministry in that movie. And I'm like, really? Stanley Kubrick, Mr., you know, keep your eyes open, Clockwork Orange shit. That's your last request, put Ministry. But you know what? Ministry definitely makes you feel a certain way. I think Steven Spielberg didn't necessarily do Kubrick a total solid, but I think that Ministry was awesome in that movie.
Yeah. Al would like smoke crack in interviews and then at the it was rough. Yeah, like Spin magazine, Rolling Stone, all the biggest magazines that he would smoke crack and then Maria make sure they don't write about it.
Oh God.
My God.
That sounds very Lemmy thing to do.
And I'm telling you, I grew fucking balls, man. Like working the bands that I worked with and with the people that I worked with, you had to like, so Siobhan, you asked me about like being a woman in the industry and shit. You just fucking go. You don't think about it. You just do what you got to do and go. Doesn't matter if I, you know, have a vagina or not. It's like, I just got to get what I got to get done.
Right. Was there, I don't know if you can talk about any of this, but were there any like crazy, like damage control things that you had to do in terms
of? Yeah, like I said right there, or like, you know, the opening of Lollapalooza, Al Jorgensen pulling the fucking fire alarm in the hotel and like everybody having to get up at like 3 a.m. and we're half naked, like running out, the fire alarm's going off. And then you have to deal with that kind of shit.
Yeah. Well, you have to have such a vision, I'm sure, for the people that you work with and understanding what's best for them, because you've got, you know, the publicity mind of like, what is going to help this band be
the most. I was contacted by a person, an artist, just last night. I'm definitely not going to name who it is. You could probably figure it out. They've had some like women stuff, like beating women stuff and, you know, Trump supporting shit and like fucking conspiracy theorists shit. And I was like, oof. And it's not even somebody that I have a good personal relationship with, but okay, well, if I can help, let me help. So like right on the call, I went right in and I said, okay, you have a mess to clean up. This isn't about your live stream or your shows coming up. You actually have a lot of shit to clean up. And I think right now is not a good time. Like you should go away for a year, go do some good work, you know, volunteer, you know, fucking go speak in a boy's home, military shit, metal community service, whatever the fuck it is. And then it became a desperation. Now the artist is calling me and the manager, they're constantly, I'm like, guys, really, I'm telling you, this is what you should do. Just go away. I got an email today thanking me. They said, you know, thanks. We're actually going to give this a break right now. This is not a good time. And I'm like, right on. Go fucking, you want people to change what they say about you? Change what you're doing.
Yeah. One thing that Siobhan said a little while ago was having like the publicity brain. Is there something, you know, your job is constant problem solving, I assume. And you know, as things come up and not just in bad ways, but
problem solving is getting it done. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. So how do you think that that's something
you care and you try? That's a success. I fucking feel amazing every night putting my head on the pillow because I know I did absolutely everything I possibly could do. I don't even leave my desk without checking every email, answering everything, handling even fucking throwing shit in schedules or reports, like, get it out of my way. Like, yeah, no, everything, getting calls into the people, you know, I don't take no for an answer. You know, sometimes it might be no for now. It's no for now. It is not no.
No is just a segue to yes.
Yeah.
I like that. They're either closing you on no or you're closing them on yes. And Maria, this is why we have you working with Adrenaline PR for Lost Symphony, our band, which we haven't even talked about. So like by the way, I just want to say that I know that this has been an uphill battle for you guys because we play in one of the most unmarketable bands in the history of heavy metal. I don't disagree with you.
Everything, every element. You have every element. It's perfect.
Well, I'm glad you think so. My mom thinks so too.
You got to get on tour. That's really my opinion. Got to get out there and play.
Scott, are you listening?
Yeah. Yeah. That's obviously, you know, since we started this, it's always been like, wow, I wonder if we could ever tour.
How do you see this happening?
But exactly. The issue being is
what about even a live stream, you know?
Yeah, it would be. I'm just thinking of how that would somehow become my responsibility.
Production.
We have Jim too.
That's good. No, yeah, but
come on.
You know, we have the core band, but because we're so guest centric on a lot of the tracks, I think that would be a very well thought out plan for whether it's a live stream.
We have guitar players that are good enough that could absolutely play if we play the songs.
I'm saying that it would take a lot of prep.
Some of those guys are so good that we just have to be better, just not that. Like, dude, if we said Joey learned, this is a true story. So Joey Concepcion, who plays on our record, he came down a long time ago with Ollie Herbert here and a guy named Matt LaPierre, and he just absolutely shredded my face off. And he was like, dude, I don't think like anyone's gonna like my playing. And I'm like, oh no, they're definitely gonna like your playing, man. You know, like Back to the Future. Like, this is the music you've been looking for. And then I found out a few years later that he was called like at a last minute basis to replace Jeff Loomis because Jeff had some family stuff he had to take care of at the Wacken Open Air Festival for Arch Enemy. And I went and watched the set, and the kid does not miss a single note from Jeff Loomis, who's the dude that like climbed Mount Everest and can play Jason Becker note for note while staring at a camera. And this kid didn't miss anything. And he was like literally 2 years before telling me how he didn't think he was good enough to even play on Lost Symphony. And like here he is playing for Jeff Loomis, and actually brought Jeff Loomis to Lost Symphony because he was with him in Belgium. And he was like, hey man, have you heard of this Lost Symphony project? And I had actually emailed him 4 years before, like, Jeff, hey dude. And he was like, dude, I shouldn't be doing stuff that like my label doesn't do and all that. And you know, I don't blame him because I would say no too. But this time he actually came and played with us, and it was one of those things where like Joey like went from being the grasshopper to the dude telling me how to wax on, wax off. And I was such a proud Jewish martyr.
Awesome. That clip, by the way, changing the subject, that clip of Ollie, really, god, totally stops my heart.
Well, I will say that there's probably, by the time this is out, we're going to be releasing a video that Ollie was a take guy, so there's like a lot of stuff that we, you know, you people Frankenstein and all that, but Ollie was a guy that like a lot of times like this burst of genius would come out amongst the shit. not to say that there wasn't shit. Corey can attest to it, and so can Siobhan. But there was
we did a lot of the stuff. A lot of the stuff was being worked out in real time, so it's, I wouldn't call it shit.
We got one of the solos. We had some of the footage of him actually playing. So we made it like a almost like a quarantine video, but with some of the artwork from Boris Groh, like we did with Take Another Piece. But it has Ollie. It has Ollie actually playing the actual song. And the I guess somewhat irony is that the song was originally called My Last Goodbye, and it was for my friend Jimmy, who passed away. And Ollie, I asked Ollie if he'd play on it. And by the time we released it, it's now become the song that features Ollie, kind of like the D at the end of the Ozzy Osbourne Randy Rhoads tribute. We figured we had to put a song, so we saved a song. We figured that the song that we wrote as a tribute to my friend would become the tribute to Ollie. So that's the next single should be out available now.
I believe it, by the time this comes out, it should potentially be.
Oh, yeah. I can tell you if it's any good. I don't know how it looks yet, but I hope it's good.
I'll let you know when I
tomorrow
start it.
It's gonna be out, but I'm gonna see it tomorrow, right? Yeah.
Hopefully tomorrow night, but we'll see.
That clip, honestly. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So check it out, LostSymphony.com.
Right. But yeah, I mean, Lost Symphony, it is a big project with a lot of different people. So it's interesting to conceptualize, you know, formulating a live show out of it. You know, I think that's part of, like you said, that has to be part of your strategy. Like, how do you perform live? You know, how do you go on tour? How do you do all of these things?
Bring it to the people.
Yeah.
Well, first off, one of the great ideas that Dan Beck had was I was a DJ in another lifetime. Why don't I just DJ like Mike Patton, all the background stuff, like the whole orchestra, and then we can just have the one
DJ the whole orchestra, so you're cutting me out.
No. Other than you, you could do the live part, like just like one part that they can clearly see is you. And then
Siobhan Shredder, man.
I can move from part to part, like so I can like hit like the sampler, and we can do enough live stuff, and Corey can be hitting like bass things with his like and doing a lot of different stuff like me, like Mike Patton-y. And we'll make it like KMFDM or like Chemical Brothers or all that sort of stuff, where we're going from like two different stations, and then we get killer shredders. Fucking killer shredder like a Jeff Loomis or Joey Concepcion or Hector Hellion, who with his owls, and we'll fucking get those guys on stage and we'll make them play all the parts, dude, and it'll fucking work. And Kelly obviously will be a part of it, and like we'll beg Paul to play it. If he won't, Shannon Larkin will do it. Fuck it. I guarantee you he'll show up. That dude was awesome in Wrathchild.
Totally.
I didn't know. In fact, you want to know what Motorhead story for you? So Shannon Larkin, I'm telling him how, dude, after Pantera stopped, like metal died for me in my heart. That like my brain stopped encoding. They're like Mastodon. And then I went and had to see them before I was like, they're good. Same with All That Remains.
I didn't like Pantera when they were popular.
But the point was is that I didn't even know All That Remains when Ollie came down because they were after. So like for me, I'm like, dude, Vinnie Paul was like the goat for me on drums and all this and that. And like, then, you know, Shannon's like, listen, man, Vincent hadn't even heard Ace of fucking Spades. He came down and we were with him in Dallas and they opened up for us. And he was like, what was that double bass shit you were fucking doing, man? And I'm like, that was Motorhead. And I'm like, wait, he's like, well, so let me tell you one thing right now. I taught Vincent that style. And I didn't know, because I've seen him with Godsmack and I know he's great, but I hadn't seen him with Wrathchild and our drummer Paul Lorenzo, who's like an old curmudgeonly guy who's like, what do you mean there's bands after 1988? He was like, Wrathchild? I used to watch Headbangers Ball just to see Wrathchild and put it up for me. And I'm like, wait a minute, that's Shannon Larkin in like the giant Megadeth style huge Gibraltar rack floating like New York apartment drum set, and he fucking ruled at like 19 years old, was playing the craziest shit that was as good as anything Anthrax or Metallica or Megadeth. So when we had David Abbruzzese on the show, I thought that he was the one learning from David, but David in fact saw him in Wrathchild and thought he was awesome before he saw him in Pearl Jam with Lollapalooza.
Wow.
I learned something. Cool.
And here
he
we are.
He schooled me. He's like, Benny, here's the deal.
And Vincent, where do we go from here?
It all goes down, man. We just go downhill.
Where do we go?
No, I guess, you know, with the whatever. Ooh, Siobhan just disappeared into.
Can you guys hear me?
You're glitching. You look like an old Atari game right now.
I see creating
right now. Yeah. We created happy little trees.
Yeah,
happy little trees.
But yeah, Maria, I guess in the last 7 or 8 minutes, what do you see for the future of music right now? How do you think things are going to come back?
COVID, get out of the way, please, soon, and just get back to releasing music. And touring, seriously, I've seen bands hold off on releasing records, keep pushing it. They still keep pushing it. Cradle of Filth is now coming out the end of October. That was, seemingly coming out much sooner.
Oh, Richard Shaw told us he had done the guitars 3 years ago, and that because it's taken so long that Danny Filth decides to add Glockenspiel or something every month that gets continued, and he's all of a sudden he's finding theremin and all kinds of strange instruments, and it's just because Danny has time to brood in the studio. He's like, come on, man, there's gonna be a Celtic record by the time that album comes out.
God fucking hell. Oh god,
I've been able to extrapolate from my conversations with our British ambassador, Mr. Richard Shaw, who's one of the greatest guitar players that I wasn't aware of. Again, that I tip my hat to that guy, because what an amazing player, Richard Shaw from Cradle of Filth. And I can only imagine what that record's going to sound like.
I'm dying for it. Yep. But anyway, so then, and Lamb of God, they put their record out last year. It was supposed to come out in May. They pushed it 1 month till June, and that was rough. Mm. Best record they ever made, and it just came out just at the worst time. So COVID really has to go away, because fans need to connect with their bands to make it happen.
Yeah, well, I mean, it seems like there's lots of tour announcements and shows being, every day there's something new. So
yeah, we're working Gemini Syndrome tour. We have a Tetrarch tour coming up, Cradle tour, Lamb of God, of course, with Megadeth. Guys, what do you think about this Ellefson stuff? Not what happened. I could give a shit less.
Him and
the band, him and Megadeth. Not about what happened. I could care less.
When I think of Megadeth, I think of David Ellefson. So it's just one of those things that, as a staunch fan, I understand. If it has Dave Mustaine on it, just like Rob Zombie, it sounds like Rob Zombie, or it sounds like Megadeth. You know what I mean? So no matter what, it's easy to discount where they got there. But really, but all that said, I don't know when it became rock and roll to fire people because of something that wasn't even illegal and didn't really even happen. And it may be distasteful, and I'm not here to judge, but man, you're talking about stuff with Al from Ministry, and look, I know all kinds of crazy stuff that's gone on. It's not a pissing contest in any way. Rock and roll is not the most beautiful thing, okay? But I guess to set a precedent, it's kind of the same thing as everyone getting mad about everything in the comedy industry, where every comedian's afraid to tour now because there's so much cancel culture that people get mad about one thing, and they don't feel the need. They attack someone's complete career.
Ellefson used to want me to cut his hair. I used to cut his hair into spikes. Oh god. And Siobhan, you were asking before, what was it like back then, after Glow in the Dark Keychain work and shit. Megadeth rehearsed in a storage space. All these bands in LA, they rehearsed in storage rooms. And man, it was hot as fuck in there, and they would be jamming. And just when you mentioned Gar Samuelson before, I remember he would be drumming in the band. Probably the year later, maybe this was 84, because I would travel back and forth. But he would smoke cigarettes, and this long cigarette hanging out of his mouth, big ash, and his arms just like an octopus, all over the place. But this ash, the cigarette would be standing still as he was just fucking flailing. What a drummer. I would have loved to have seen him play with Alex Skolnick.
I remember watching the behind the music for Megadeth, and one of the things that Dave Mustaine says on it, and I'm sorry if I'm paraphrasing it, but it was I saw Gar Samuelson sitting with a cigarette, and it was already down to the nub, and he had fallen asleep, and it was burning his fingers, and he was still sleeping. And I was like, I know this guy is the real deal. Jesus. You know, and I was like, oh man, I'm like, that sounds rock and roll to me. He's so real deal. He fell asleep with the cigarette in his hand, and it's burning through his fingers. He's like, well, fuck it, I'm still gonna play drums.
Jesus Christ.
I mean, Garth Samuelson, you know, and then the fact is you said the same thing when he's flailing his arms. Did you know him? What was that guy like?
He was like older. He seemed like he wasn't interested. You know what I mean? Like he was not interested.
Interesting.
Yeah. You know?
So he just showed up and played the gig and then it was kind of like, I'm over this.
Yeah. That's what it felt like with him. Yeah.
Interesting.
He didn't get involved in too many antics, I think. But I think they did a lot of drugs later on, like, I think.
As you do.
I feel like Megadeth did a lot of drugs.
Yeah. No, but
I feel like they did like an Aerosmith amount of drugs.
Real bad. And Ellefson, 1984, me and Bobby Gustafson, I remember we went to L.A. To hang out with Megadeth. We went to Disney. I have photos of all the shit. And then we went to San Francisco. They had their first show opening for Exodus at the Kabuki Theater. And Ellefson was dating Dawn Crosby from Detente. Ross Robinson's band. And she was like, you got to go see this band, Sisters of Mercy. They're playing at the Kabuki the night before Megadeth show. We were like, what the fuck is that? She took us and man, that changed my life. That was another one of those like, you know, hearing Black Sabbath for the first time, seeing a goth band in San Francisco, Sisters of Mercy, fucking 1984. That was wild.
Wow.
It's amazing how vivid, like so many people we've talked to have these vivid memories of like their first experience of something that was like life changing when it comes to music, like a show or an album or a song. And it's so cool to hear, you know, like what your first experience, like something that really changed your perspective.
What was your first concert, like your first rock or metal concert?
I don't know. I mean, my first concert ever was the Spice Girls with my mom and my grandma.
Awesome.
But to be honest, yeah, I mean, I really did not go see Rocket. I mean, I grew up playing violin and piano, classical music, like very, you know, square childhood.
No, not square, just that was it. That's cool.
Yeah, it was. So, I mean, to me, like an exciting concert was going to see the symphony or like some great soloist. And that was like something I really looked forward to. And now, you know, in my career, I'm playing with like such different types of music. And it's so interesting for me to hear the stories of people that grew up loving rock and metal and going to these shows. Cause that's something I did not experience at all growing up.
Wow.
So
it's Elton John with Kirk Hammett. Why? That was pretty fucking rad.
Wow.
We were backstage talking with Elton. I was freaking out. He was freaking out. We were all freaking out.
I can only imagine. Well, Maria, you're like a treasure trove of this rock history here. Thank you for taking the time and hanging with us. This has been amazing. It's good to actually get to speak with you, not through an email CC for once.
Yeah, we got a lot more to do, guys. Like, honestly, guys and gals. We do. Yeah.
You're our metal ambassador. We have Steve Wood is our British ambassador, along with Richard Shaw from Cradle of Filth. He's also, because everything that Richard says, because of his beautiful accent and because of his eloquent and articulate nature, it just sounds awesome. I know it could be total horseshit, but from him. I believe, like, if a plane was about to crash, I'd want to hear Richard Shaw's voice.
Flying south, yes.
Yeah, I'd want to hear Richard Shaw's voice. I'd be like, that's fine. But I would love for you to be our metal ambassador because, I mean, James Hetfield himself. I mean, the godfather of metal. I mean, not Ozzy Osbourne. Ozzy Osbourne's the king. But, like, but the godfather, James Hetfield, bestowed upon you the name Metal Maria. And you, and you do. And I don't want to say you work for us. Like, we are lucky enough to have you help us.
I feel lucky enough to have you guys to work with. Honestly. And that's
so
great.
Making us feel
we appreciate everything you're doing.
It's great. It's only the beginning. Wait till I know the single's going to be out after this, but like, wait till this drops.
Yeah. You really think something's going to happen with this Ollie thing? Because I mean, it moved me when I watched it because I found it because I had uploaded the clip and I thought Corey had it. He's like, dude, it's not uploaded. I'm like, really? So I found it. And when I watched it, I was like, I had goosebumps. I was like, holy shit. Because it's also the exact take, and it's just like such magic. And I just chose to put my phone out at that moment because we ended up filming towards the end with him a lot, but like at the beginning, especially for that song, which was one of the first songs we did, like that was literally like one of two videos that we just found, and I just happened to have nailed the actual take of the 10 million we did. So it was crazy serendipity that we'll be able to put this together the way that Corey is right now.
his personality, man, comes right through on that.
Yeah.
Yeah. What an awesome guy.
Well, it'll be a good video, a good song.
Hope He's everyone checks it out. The stars align for me and Starset over here.
Yes.
It's true. Absolutely. That's how we met.
Awesome.
It all comes full circle.
So, Marie, I just want to say, first off, thank you so much again for all your help with Lost Symphony. Like, we know that you've, like, you've alluded to it. That, like, look, this has been a really hard year. And look, as entertainers, like, the whole reason this show started was because we were defeated doing what you're doing. And the fact is you're still fighting the fight. And every single day you're getting back up, and like, we got to congratulate you because you're still here. You're still alive. And look, I know there's a lot more scars and it hurts a lot with all this stuff, but it's good to get it out. We've been doing it through this show and we hope that you'll come back and tell us way more, because we would love to pick your brain, because I think I speak on behalf of all of us, and they can speak if they feel otherwise, but like, you're awesome. And like, we really appreciate how honest you've been with us, how open you've been with us, and how much you've cared about this project genuinely, which is something that's so important to anyone listening, that if you get somebody who's into PR, whether you know, there's a lot of different people. You have to make sure someone's representing you that like really knows what you're doing. Care. And like, there's really no question. Care. There's no question. And we appreciate that on so many levels.
Bravo.
So thank you.
I appreciate you guys. It's
thank you.
No, more to come. Yeah. Sean, I think, didn't you guys play at APMAs 1 year?
Yeah, we did. Started. Like, that was early on for me. It was like probably 4 years ago or 3 years ago. Cool.
I think even longer.
Maybe
we
longer.
Did press for all of the APMAs.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
So cool. Yeah. I remember that.
Wonder if you guys will run into each other coming the upcoming touring seasons.
Yeah. I certainly hope so.
But
definitely. And I'd come back anytime, guys.
Sounds great.
Maria, we'll definitely keep in touch. I mean,
so check out 2020-d.com. Like and subscribe. Do all those things we always tell you to do, please.
Lost Symphony, chapters Lost 1, Symphony, 2, and 3.
Yep.
And Corey, you look less fat since you haven't stopped drinking, so.
Thank you.
I wanted you to know, like, I've noticed that you, like, I was like, what's wrong? What's wrong with Corey? I'm like, oh, he looks like he's dying. Oh, wait, he's just skinny again.
I lost weight. And then,
everyone, give everyone a round of applause for shedding the COVID.
I got to keep going, though. I want to lose, like, 30 more.
Oh, we believe in you. You can do it.
You can definitely do it.
Or you should lose 30 more, too.
I think I might die.
So mean.
Exactly.
you.
Christian Bale could do it, Corey.
Oh, he could. Nah.
And on that, you've been 2020. Thank you, Maria. Come back again. Our metal ambassador.
Marie Adrenaline
PR. Yes.
Lost Symphony.
Thank you, as always, for checking out this episode of 2020. Please visit 2020-d.com. Like and subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss out on future episodes. This week's throwback clip is from episode number 76, featuring Matthew LaPierre of 3 Years Gone and frequent Lost Symphony guest. Check it out.
Well, with Lost Symphony in particular, it was one of those things like where there were these weird modulations, but having to play at that speed and, you know, trying to be conscious of being tasteful and not just like musical masturbation, because you know that's a thing. So just kind of thinking more so like, all right, so here's, you know, I have this little shred bit that I want to throw in. This is something I'm happy with, but I want to have something that ties that into the next section, and you know, it make it cohesive enough where it sounds like, oh, this was something he thought about, not just, all right, we press record and went for it.
Hey there, I am Johnny Christ from Avenged Sevenfold, and I've got a podcast called Drinks with Johnny you're going to want to check out. I sit down with a bunch of different people from all different walks of life, from professional wrestlers to actors, comedians, fighters, musicians, everything in between. I'm just looking to make some friends and have a good time doing it. So if that sounds like something you're into, go check out Drinks with Johnny, streaming everywhere now.